This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2, streaming online, live at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest this afternoon is a neuroscientist, novelist, and actress. Her name is Lisa Genova. She's with us today to talk about her novel, Still Alice. Still Alice tells the story of Alice Howland, a Harvard professor of psychology, an authority on psycholinguistics, who at the age of 50 learns she has early-onset Alzheimer's disease. At the height of her career and seeming in excellent health, Alice at first attributes her periods of confusion and forgetting to stress and aging. But with her symptoms worsening, she sees her physician, then a neurologist. The diagnosis, early-onset Alzheimer's. Early-onset refers to Alzheimer's that occurs in a person under the age of 65. According to the Alzheimer's Association, as many as 5.3 million Americans are living with the disease, and it's estimated that some 500,000 people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s have early-onset Alzheimer's or a related dementia. Lisa Genova's knowledge of neuroscience serves her well as she takes readers through Alice's days and nights. As Alice fights and copes with Alzheimer's, so too does the art and craft of acting, as one of the central characters in the book, Alice's adult daughter, Lydia, is an actress. Lisa Genova holds a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard University. Still Alice, her first novel, has been a New York Times bestseller and has received a lot of positive attention from critics and readers. The book is available in hardcover and paperback from Pocket Books. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-9455. W-I-L-L. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-W-I-L-L. More about Lisa Genova and her novel, Still Alice, at the website www.stillalice.com, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Lisa Genova, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, first of all, what led you to these interests that you have? Neuroscience, writing, acting?
Well, neuroscience was my first passion, and I spent a lot of years pursuing that and nothing else. I graduated with a degree in biopsychology from Bates and then went on to get a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard. And I spent a lot of time doing brain research. I did not do any research on Alzheimer's there, however. My research was on the biological basis of drug addiction. The folks that did Alzheimer's research, actually probably the world's thought leaders in Alzheimer's research, those are Rudy Tanzi and his colleagues, were down the hall. So I was very much aware of what they were doing, but it wasn't my area of expertise. And then my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when she was 85. And because I think we as a culture, and my family was certainly guilty of this, because we expect a certain amount of forgetting in our elderly parents and grandparents, we think that forgetting is a normal part of normal aging, and in fact it's not. But we thought this, and so as Nana forgot more things and became a little confused about certain things that she shouldn't have, like where she lived and where the bathroom was or what time of day it was. We brushed it off at first to normal aging. And she did too, I think. I think that my grandmother was a very independent and intelligent woman and was not a complainer, so she didn't bring this to our attention either. And so by the time things got to the point where we really couldn't ignore it, she had progressed pretty far along into the disease. And so as we as a family rallied together to care for her at that point, it was difficult to understand what she was feeling. I could read the scientific literature and get up to speed very quickly about what was going on inside her head on a molecular level. Mm-hmm. And then I could do what I think a lot of families do, which is turn to the nonfiction self-help books like The 36-Hour Day and learn a lot about how to care for someone with this. But in all of those resources, which are written by clinicians and scientists and caregivers, I couldn't find an answer to the question that kept coming up for me as I was watching my grandmother's baffling behavior, which was, what does this feel like to have it? And so for me, that was the seed for the book. I knew that someday I wanted to write a book about a woman from her perspective who has Alzheimer's, from the earliest symptoms of the disease, from those earliest signs of, what did I come in this room for, or where did I put my keys, to the more confusing and profound, if I can't remember who I am, then am I still me? So that was the seed. But I wasn't a writer back then. I was a scientist. So it was kind of a crazy thing for me to think that I could do.
Yeah. And where did the acting come in?
So the acting came in just before the writing. In 2003, I had a three-year-old daughter, and my marriage was failing. I was separated, and I was in the process of getting a divorce. And sort of in all of the upheaval that time in my life was, it was also a time for starting over and starting anew. And I had quit my job. I was a strategy consultant for the biotech and pharmaceutical industry when my daughter was born. And I was planning to go back. And before doing that, I sort of thought, well, I want to try some things that I've always wanted to do that I haven't done because I've been so busy being a scientist and then a mother. So one was act. I'd always wanted to learn to act. So I trained for a year and a half as a Meisner actress with a group of actors in Boston. And then instead of going back to the job that I should have gone back to as a responsible parent and scientist, I decided not to go back to work and write the novel that I'd been wanting to write for a number of years instead. So I was acting while I was writing, and it was an incredibly fun but kind of crazy year and a half.
Yeah. Lots of interesting things we could launch into here. Let's go back to your grandmother. At 85, people thought it's normal, a little forgetting. And then, you know, it just kept on the deteriorating. And by then, you know, you've got a different situation. Also, in Still Alice, we have a woman who's, you know, she's really busy. She multitasks like crazy. She's an authority in her field. She travels. Seems like constantly on the road. And she also kind of puts it out to being, you know, too busy, too stressed. Maybe at 50, it's about menopause. So throughout, in this disease, whether it's Alzheimer's or early onset form, are we likely to put off signs that something is seriously wrong?
Yeah, I think that's a natural thing to do. And in fact, it actually is the correct thing to do. You don't want to be in denial over it, but you do want to point to something that is curable and treatable before you jump to Alzheimer's. So that's, I think, a natural inclination, and it's also the right thing to do. So you do want to check to see, am I getting enough sleep? Am I too stressed? Am I drinking too much? These types of questions are good ones to ask, and you should check in not only with yourself, but with the people who see you regularly and your physician. It can be a vitamin deficiency. There are things that are treatable that can cause symptoms of dementia that are similar to what you'd see with Alzheimer's. And certainly if you're young, I mean, Alzheimer's is typically not on people's radar. But in fact, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, there are about 500,000 Americans who have Alzheimer's or a related dementia, and these are people in their 40s and 50s and early 60s. So it's if you do have Alzheimer's and it's not attributable to lack of sleep or stress or menopause, then it is best to get a diagnosis as soon as possible. However difficult and life-changing that's going to be. If you do, in fact, have the disease, there are things that you can do about it. There's no cure currently, but there are things you can do to maintain the quality of life that you have now for longer, and there are important ways that you can prepare for your future if you have, or if you're armed with knowledge.
Yeah. In the story, we learn that Alice's father may have had Alzheimer's. If he did, it went undiagnosed, and it was hidden by his alcoholism. What is the value of diagnosis and early diagnosis?
That is a great question. So many people think, and by so many people, it's not just families and people who have the disease. It's actually general practice physicians often have this sort of misconception as well, that, well, there's no cure for Alzheimer's, so why do I want to put a family through getting diagnosed? It's just going to be a painful thing to learn, and they're better off not knowing. It's very important to know, and there's a number of reasons. The first is, and there was a study done last fall out of Massachusetts General Hospital and another study done out of the National Institute of Health, which were the first long-term studies done over 2 to 4 years that showed that patients with Alzheimer's who take the two currently approved drugs for treating Alzheimer's, so one is called Namenda, which is, also goes by the name of memantine. So they're on Namenda and an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor like Aricept. So patients who are on Namenda and Aricept decline less than patients who are just on Aricept and decline even less than patients who are on nothing. So everyone gets worse over time, but people who are on these two drugs maintain a cognitive footing for much longer. And that's important for a number of reasons. It's quality of life, and that's obviously very important. And the other is because scientists are working feverishly at discovering the next generation of drugs to stop the progression of Alzheimer's. And these drugs are in clinical trials, and we have great hope for them. And if you have Alzheimer's and you can maintain the level of cognitive function that you have now for longer, you're going to be in a better position to reap the benefits of a drug like the ones that are in clinical trials should they become available. The other thing is that we know from animal studies is that aerobic exercise can help to stave off the accumulation of amyloid beta 42, which is the protein that clogs up your neurons and keeps you from remembering and causes the forgetting. Aerobic exercise, for some reason that we don't entirely understand yet, helps stave off this clogging as well as any pharmaceutical we know of. So if you know you have this, you can do things like exercise. We know that Mediterranean diet helps. We know that reducing stress, so meditating, yoga, getting a good night's sleep, all of these things can help to maintain your quality of life for as long as possible.
Yeah. There was an article recently in the Wall Street Journal about the value of golf for people with Alzheimer's disease. Those folks that had golfed their entire lives and now have Alzheimer's disease, but there's something that happens when they're out there on the course, on the greens, that, I don't know, that sort of revives them. Is that the right word?
Well, I didn't see the article, but I can easily imagine that there's a lot of things that goes on for that person. It's probably somewhat a relaxing and meditative experience if mm-hmm. you've been golfing your whole life, to be out in the open air and to have that level of focus and concentration. It's, you know, a slow focus and concentration, like someone who might be meditating or practicing Tai Chi or yoga. There's also a social aspect to it. People who are able to stay socially networked, and this is why support groups are so important for people with Alzheimer's. Social contact is very important for maintaining the health of our neural connections. So there may be a number of things going on mm-hmm. for that golfer.
Yeah. For Alice, her social network really is her family and her workplace. It was striking to me that she really didn't have any friends.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In the original draft of the book, I gave her a best friend. But I found that I was diluting a certain impact of Alzheimer's mm-hmm. between her best friend and her daughter, Lydia. And in the end, I decided to delete her best friend and give all of that stuff to the relationship between Alice and Lydia and deepen that and make it more compelling. And I also found that that could be true for that kind of story. You know, I did not become a professor, but that was a career path that was certainly an option, and I saw a lot of what goes on, and there are very few women who stay on as a tenured professor in the sciences at a place like Harvard. And when they do, it's a life that is very overscheduled and busy, and there's not a lot of time to stay in close contact with people outside of your academic circle.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be uncommon for someone as high-powered as Alice to have sort of lost social contact beyond her professional life.
And that's one of the struggles she has, because her identity is so wrapped up in her work.
Yeah, so I purposefully chose a woman whose identity and worth would be placed in what she does for a living. And I think a lot of us do that. We place our worth in what we do. And I wanted what she did to be cerebral, intellectual. So this is someone who thinks for a living. So what happens if you place all your value in being able to think, and then along comes Alzheimer's and you're no longer able to do that? So then she'll have to struggle with questions like, well, who am I now and how can I matter? And if I can't live entirely in my head, well, maybe she can learn to live a little bit more from her heart.
Yeah. And there are points in the story after her diagnosis where we see her relax in who she is and where she is at the moment. There's a triple dip peanut butter ice cream cone. There's a cutting class. And then there's also a very touching scene, a moonlight swim in the ocean with her husband, John. Was it clear to you when you began writing this book that Alice would discover that she is still Alice, even as her memory and her language ability and so much that is so important to her is being destroyed by this disease?
I didn't know that at first. A lot of writing this book was truly a process of discovery for me. In the course of doing the research, I came to know over 20 people who are diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's or related dementia. And these people really helped me understand what it feels like to have this and what they go through. And I got to know Alzheimer's on a human level and not just what you read in a textbook or what physicians see or what caregivers see. I got to understand more of the humanity of living with Alzheimer's. And it was became a powerful distinction for me that, you know, I think people that don't have Alzheimer's hear the words and immediately think of someone who's much older, who's in end stage of the disease, who is vacant-eyed and doesn't know anyone anymore and is perhaps in a nursing home lying in a bed. But in fact, there's life between diagnosis and end stage, and that life is one that still matters and is worth living. And these people that I've come to know who have Alzheimer's want to live that life as well as they can. And so that message became sort of, it just became so important and so obvious to me as I came to know people who are living with this and doing their best to adapt and to cope and to contribute to their families and the world while they're here.
Lisa Genova is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a neuroscientist, she's a novelist, she's an actress, and she is with us this afternoon to talk about Alzheimer's disease and her novel, Still Alice. Still Alice tells the story of Alice Howland, a Harvard professor of psychology, an authority on psycholinguistics, who at the age of 50 is diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Describe Lydia for us, please.
Well, Lydia is the black sheep of the family, originally, or at least to Alice. Alice has three children. They're all in their 20s. The first two, Anna is a lawyer and Tom is in medical school, and so the first two have sort of followed similar traditional academic paths to their parents. Alice and her husband John are both Harvard professors. And then Lydia comes along and doesn't want to go to college. She wants to pursue an acting career out in Los Angeles. And she and Alice have been butting heads over this decision for years. And the book begins with that sort of in process, that they're out of touch and they're estranged. And when they are together, they invariably get into the same argument. They can't help themselves. Mm-hmm. And they just don't see eye to eye. And Alice's want for her is to get an education and something so that if acting doesn't work out, she has a life that she can fall back on and a career that she can move to. And Lydia thinks that her mother just wants her to do what her mother did. So Lydia's taking her own path, and the two of them are at odds before Alice has Alzheimer's. And through her disease, the two of them figure out a way to see each other in the moment and accept each other and to sort of meet on a common ground where they can start a new relationship. Because you do have to, if someone you love has Alzheimer's, you do end up having to create a new relationship with this person. Someone with Alzheimer's will lose access to their personal history and might not remember who you are after a period of time, or may not hold on to certain ways of thinking that they always did, and the person that you have known for your life isn't able to access that information anymore. Their brain doesn't have that information. So you have to come to a new relationship with this person and be willing to do that. And of the three children, Lydia is the most able to accept her mother wherever her mother happens to be in the given moment.
Yeah. I've got a listener who wants to talk with us, and I want to get to this caller right away, but I do have to ask, is there something of King Lear's daughter Cordelia in Lydia?
That's a great question. Not intentionally, but
okay.
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's take a call now. Listener in Champaign, line one, hi.
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 My name is Amelia. I'm a speech therapist. And I work in nursing homes, so I have had a lot of experience working with patients with Alzheimer's that typically are elderly. And I'm curious, you know, how would you recommend talking to a family who has counseling them and, you know, explaining to them what's going on with maybe a younger person that has the early onset Alzheimer's? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, in terms of counseling a family who is going through this with a loved one who's much younger, it is different because hopefully that younger person has been diagnosed in the earlier stages. And so it depends on what stage they've been diagnosed, what sort of counseling the family needs. Support groups for both the person with Alzheimer's and the family is very helpful. This disease can be very isolating. There's still like a social stigma and a shame that it attaches to this, and so people feel like they can't come out and talk about it. It reminds me of what cancer was like, you know, 30, 40 years ago when people called it the big C. So having a place where you can talk about this with others who are going through similar experiences and maybe a little further ahead of you in the journey or maybe a little further behind, and you can offer advice. So support is important. And then it depends on where they are, understanding whether this is the right time to talk about no longer driving a car, whether this is the right time to talk about getting help at home, whether it's the time to talk about getting help outside the home. You know, different family members will be in different stages of grief. So there's, you know, denial and anger and bargaining and the various stages until you get to acceptance. And I've found with the people I've come to know that not everyone goes through these stages at the same rate. So someone diagnosed with Alzheimer's may very well get to acceptance before their husband or wife does. And so it becomes challenging for counselors, but very important to, you know, get everybody at the same place at some point so that they can begin to make the most of the time they have.
Yeah. How does John accomplish that in the novel Still Alice?
That's a great question. I think that John has the hardest time of anyone coming to terms with what has happened. I think he stayed in denial longer than anyone. He desperately wants to find a way out of this and has a hard time looking at his wife. He doesn't want to see her take her medications. He gets physically agitated when she makes mistakes. He does he tries so hard to show up for her and give her what she needs. And he does a pretty good job of it over the summer when he doesn't have to work. But when work obligations come in and Alice starts to get worse and he has to make some difficult choices, I think that that John has a hard time meeting Alice where Alice wants him to go.
Yeah. I found myself crying a lot for John.
Yeah, people have very mixed feelings about John. And, you know, it was a challenging line for me to walk in the book. I didn't want to in any way over-dramatize or romanticize this disease, and I certainly didn't want to minimize it either. I mean, I tried as much as possible to tell the truth under these imaginary circumstances. And Alice's husband, John, is not perfect. He does not do what a lot of readers want him to do. But I found his decisions and what struggles he had to face very real and honest.
Yeah.
And I tell the story from Alice's point of view. So we don't get to know what's going on inside the thoughts of John or Alice's children. We only get to see what is revealed to us through Alice's senses. So we lose what is going on inside John's head, and we can only guess based on what he does. I made this decision because I thought it was the most powerful one to stick with Alice, so we'd be right with her as she experiences her Alzheimer's, and we'd have that very visceral sense of what it feels like. But while I was writing the book, I kept a separate notebook for John so I could keep track of him and what he was thinking and feeling along the way. And so I have great compassion and sympathy for John.
Yeah, I do too. I respect him. He's a real guy.
Thank you.
And a very tough, you know, you can feel his grief.
Yeah, he was faced with losing the woman he obviously loves. Their marriage was not as strong as it could have been when this disease came in, and I think that that's something a lot of people experience, that, you know, the intimacy that you start out with can fade and go to the background as you care for children and tend to your job and your career and you pay the bills and you do all the practical things that life demands of you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sort of, you know, living in parallel. And if some crisis comes along, like Alzheimer's disease, and it requires you to find a very strong and intimate connection again, for some people that may be a hard thing to find again.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Lisa Genova, author of Still Alice, a novel, is our guest today. Listeners, if you'd like to join us, you are welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Alice decides as part of the diagnostic process to undergo a genetic test. Two of her three children decide to be tested. As you did your research, what did you learn about how people make that choice?
Well, it's important to know for listeners that genetic testing right now is not a perfect science. And it's best for people who have early onset Alzheimer's. So if you have late onset, which is Alzheimer's after the age of 65, it's very unlikely that you have a single mutation that causes your disease. There's probably a number of things that have had to have gone wrong to sort of funnel down to give you Alzheimer's. But if you're under the age of 65 and this runs in your family, if your mother is diagnosed and her sister had it and her cousin had it and one of your cousins is becoming diagnosed, if it's all over the place, then you may have a genetic mutation that runs in your family that causes the disease. And right now, we know of three mutations. We've identified three mutations that cause Alzheimer's. So if you have a mutation in one of these three genes, it's presenilin-1, presenilin-2, or amyloid precursor protein. If you have a mutation in one of those three genes, you will get Alzheimer's disease 100% of the time. And if you do have one of those three mutations, then each of your children has a 50% chance of inheriting that mutation, which causes the disease. So for Alice, who goes ahead and gets the testing, a positive result, a positive mutation, will in fact tell you that you do have the disease or you are going to get the disease. But a negative result doesn't tell you anything. A negative result means, well, you don't have one of the three mutations that we know of, but you could have a mutation that we just haven't identified yet, or you could have nothing. So a negative doesn't tell you anything. So it's not a perfect screen. But they go ahead and do this anyway, and Alice is, in fact, positive for one of the three mutations. So then her children, who are in their 20s, and in fact her oldest daughter is trying to get pregnant and start a family. So her three children are now faced with the possibility that they might too carry this gene that causes Alzheimer's 100% of the time. And they have to decide whether they want to know this information or not, and how will this affect, you know, their hopes and dreams for their own futures and their relationships with each other. So if one is positive and one is not, you know, how does that affect how they can be with each other going forward?
Yeah. Tom and Anna are characters in a novel, but, you know, you can put yourself in their shoes pretty easily. Here they are in their 20s. Lydia, too, she decides not to get tested. But, you know, you've got to wonder, you know, if I was in their shoes, should I be tested? Number one, do I want to know? How would I live with it? Number two, if we get a positive. But, you know, what about, you know, here are people who are just starting out in their lives and is, you know, looking forward to, you know, to Anna, to a family, and she's also a high-powered attorney, Tom, who's in medicine, and Lydia, who's in acting. They're really at the outset of their careers. So I would think you've got to be thinking about, well, what about employment? What about health insurance? What about long-term care insurance? What's the story there?
It's a great question, and I think it differs by healthcare provider and by state, and it is complicated, and it is, as far as I know, and I don't know a lot, so I won't be able to give you a precise answer, it doesn't work well right now, and in fact, you're right. I've heard families talk about, well, I better not find out because then I'll lose my long-term care, possibility for long-term care, or I won't be eligible for my health insurance. I've known a woman who was diagnosed with early onset, and this wasn't through genetic screening, but in fact her diagnosis caused her to lose her job, and that was legally something that shouldn't have happened, but she had to go through the painstaking ordeal and time of going to lawyers and getting it straightened out and getting compensated. And so finding out you have Alzheimer's or that you will have Alzheimer's does have legal implications. It does have implications for health insurance and beyond what it does to you emotionally and psychologically. So it's a very complicated issue.
Yeah. Talk some more with us about the issue of employment. What are the issues from the points of view of employee and employer, and how does Alice handle her situation in the novel, Still Alice?
Well, for Alice, she at first decides not to tell anyone. Because she at first believes that she's still a healthy monitor of her own performance and behavior, and she feels like, she hopes that she'll be able to recognize when she's slipping to the point that she really should excuse herself. And she doesn't want to wait too long because she doesn't want to be gossiped about or pitied, and she doesn't want to do a bad job. She prides herself in her teaching and in the respect that she's gained over the years through her performance. So she doesn't tell anyone at first, and it turns out that she has been slipping and forgetting and not performing as well as she was able to be conscious of. And her student evaluations come back, and they're not good. And so she has to have a conversation with her, the head of the department, who is not thinking it could possibly be anything like Alzheimer's. He thinks that maybe she's got a drinking problem or maybe her marriage is on the rocks or something's going on, but he never thinks Alzheimer's. But when she tells him this, he immediately becomes very pragmatic and thinks, well, you know, parents are paying a fortune for students to attend school here. If this gets out that you have Alzheimer's and you continue to teach, there's going to be sound bites on the local news. This is going to, you know, people are going to be in an uproar over this, and we can't have you representing Harvard giving lectures all over the world if you're not reliable in terms of what you're going to be able to say and how you're going to be able to perform. So he asks her to, he says he'll support her, but he asks her to step out. And I did some research on that. I talked to the provost at Harvard and asked how the administration would handle someone with Alzheimer's who was on staff. And it was similar to how I wrote it, that they would like to try and support the professor for as long as possible, but with the eye on that this is still a school and education, the quality of the education should come first.
Yeah. Is stigma a challenge here as well?
Yeah, of course. I think that Alice struggled with, even with the highly educated, so she's at a place like Harvard where people know that, what Alzheimer's is and are fairly knowledgeable. But it's still sort of, it's treated like a mental illness, and people are fearful and don't want to get too close to it. And there's an awkwardness, and, well, what if she forgets something while she's talking to me? And what if she forgets what I said 5 minutes ago? Then what will I do? Or what's safe to ask? Or people tend to shy away from someone with Alzheimer's, and it doesn't matter if you're at a place like Harvard or anywhere. That's what tends to happen.
Mm. The story begins with a description of the death of neurons in Alice's brain. And it begins, even then, more than a year earlier, there were neurons in her head not far from her ears that were being strangled to death too quietly for her to hear them. Can you give us some sense of what is happening to the brain with Alzheimer's? What do we know, and can you explain it in a way that we as lay people can understand?
Sure. What happens with, and so that description, I really, and it's quick, it's just a paragraph to give readers sort of an omniscient glimpse into what is going on before Alice has any idea that anything is wrong. So we used to think that neurons in your head had to die for you to get Alzheimer's, and that you would have a brain scan, you'd have an MRI, and you'd see all this empty space where all your memories used to be. And in fact, what happens well before anything dies is that there's too much of a sticky protein called amyloid beta 42. And I'll just call it amyloid beta. Either too much is made or not enough is cleared away. And what happens is it produces a clog in the synapse. And the synapse is the space between two neurons. And so the whole point of a neuron is to communicate with the next neuron. So if neuron 1 can't talk to neuron 2 because there's this amyloid beta clog in the middle, then information can't be accessed. If you're trying to remember my name, if you're trying to remember Lisa Genova, and there's a clog there, then you can't remember it. You're thinking, oh, what's her name? I can't remember. What is it? And this is why the idea of, you'll hear a lot about use it or lose it philosophy, exercising your brain. Mm-hmm. And what are people talking about? Are they just trying to get us to do, you know, endless crossword puzzles? Like, what is this? This is trying to get you to build more neural connections. So think about your neurons as like they were roads. And so if that road to my name is blocked with this roadblock, this amyloid beta sticky roadblock, and you can't get to Lisa Genova, well, what if you built up more ways to remember my name? What if you built more neural roads so that you could detour? Maybe Main Street is broken, so if the road you would typically take to my name is Author of Still Alice, and that is blocked, well, maybe you've built some other roads, like, oh, she's a neuroscientist, she's an actress who lives on Cape Cod, she you know, writes the blog for the National Alzheimer's Association. If you build these other roads and then use them, if you practice them, then they become good roads. They're not just these, you know, side streets that are, that aren't paved. You start to build these roads that are that you can travel on and get to my name again. So the idea also is if you have 10 ways of getting to a piece of information and 9 of those become clogged with amyloid beta, you still have one road left that you can find my name or the or whatever you're trying to retrieve and remember it. But if you build 100 ways to remember that piece of information, you can lose 10, you can lose 50 of those and still have a way to remember the name. So you might not even know that you have a problem if you've got 50 extra ways to get to something. Because then you think, well, I can't get there. Hold on a minute. What's her name? What's her name? Ah, Lisa Genova. There it is.
Lisa Genova is our guest this afternoon. Were you finished? Or
too much amyloid beta, clogging neurons. Yeah. And then over time, if neurons can't communicate, that's their whole job. And they'll start to send signals to each other saying, we're having a big problem. We can't seem to fix it. Send in, you know, they send in the troops. It's a, it turns out to be all-out war at the synapse, and they can't fix it despite all of their attempts. And over time, they say, all right, we're spending too much energy on this. Just give up. And they initiate a process called apoptosis, which is what I describe at the beginning of the book without calling it that, because who wants to read the word apoptosis in a novel? but they initiate programmed cell death, and they kill themselves. And that's when you start to see the empty space. And so for someone with Alzheimer's, it's very important to get a treatment before you've experienced cell death, because if you can hang around while you've just got a clog, well, if you've got a treatment that can clear that clog, then you've got neurons that are still alive and ready to work. That's actually kind of hopeful and exciting.
Let's take a call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. My brother has been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, and they actually think that he probably developed it at about 45 years of age. He's now 51. But there are two statements I wanted to make. The first one is definitely we need as a community to try and address the fact that with early onset Alzheimer's, you're dealing with some different social situations, and you touched on this with work ethic and stuff like that, because physically the body is still in very good shape, and you're dealing with an atrophying mind. And the whole feeling of, boy, you know, now I'm not as, my self-worth is now really endangered because I still am a vital person of society. You know, as of yesterday, I was still going to work, you know, I was still getting that paycheck. And now all of a sudden...
What? I don't know what happened there.
Oh,
our caller there?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Was it your fault? I don't think so. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, what I was going to say is, and I don't know where we left off, but there's a big difference between dealing with somebody with early onset and with the elderly, because their self-worth is so important at the early onset diagnosis. All of a sudden, so much of what they do comes to a major crashing halt. Yet from the outside, they look, you know, totally like another 50-year-old, you know. But the other statement that I wanted to say is in dealing with the early, there aren't a lot of support groups really out there yet dealing specifically with this. They can deal with a geriatric Alzheimer's issue, but the early onset has so many more complicated issues surrounding it that it's hard to figure out, you know, what angles to take. And that's what we've been finding as a family. But the one thing I wanted to address with the author is in your research, one positive thing is that Alzheimer's in general, if it wasn't such a devastating disease, it's also so beautiful because every day is new for these people. I mean, every day they experience something that they think is new, but it really isn't. And in some ways, if we can savor that and, you know, become energized as family members when they get excited, I think that might help in the process as well. Did you find that all at all in your research?
I did. And, I certainly included a lot of that message in the book. I've come to know people, and it's strange to say because I know there's so many families that are in the trenches with this, and it's so difficult and it's heartbreaking, and this disease does not have a happy ending yet. But there are, I've talked to people who have this, and they will tell me very honestly that there are gifts that can come with this if you choose to look at it in that way. This disease does force you for a while to live in the moment. Before you progress to the end stage, you have a harder and harder time remembering your past or what happened 20 minutes ago. And you've probably figured out a good way, not to worry too much about the future, because that'll probably spiral you into a depression. So the people who I know who have learned how to cope well and have learned how to live with this disease well know how to live in the moment. And I've spent a lot of time with them, and it truly is, I've learned a lot from these people. There's a lot of going on in this country now. A lot of people are reading and learning about how to do that, how to live in the now and be present. And for some people with Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's becomes a way to do that. So there are gifts that can come along with the tragedies and the difficulties. So it's not all, and the people I know who have Alzheimer's like stand up and cheer when I talk about this, because they want people to know that it's not all doom and gloom, the grim reaper lurking over their shoulders every minute of the day, that they want to have reasons to still laugh and enjoy their families and enjoy a beautiful day. And I do bring those elements into the story to sort of show hopefully the full picture of what this, the experience of this disease can be.
I want to thank the caller for her call this afternoon, and I'd love to have more time this afternoon, but we are out of time. I want to thank our callers this afternoon, our two callers from Champaign, and also, of course, our guest, Lisa Genova, who holds a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard University. She's also a novelist and an actress. Her first novel, Still Alice, has been a New York Times bestseller. It's received a lot of positive attention from critics and readers. The book is available in hardcover and paperback from Pocket Books. Look for Lisa Genova at the website www.stillalice.com. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Celeste. It's been a pleasure.